Good morning, and welcome to the Old Mole Variety Hour. You are tuned to KBOO Portland, and you're listening to Alicia Keys with her tune, Girl on Fire. I'm Patricia Kohlberg, and I'll be your host for the next hour. It's Women's History Month, and today we have a show for you that includes feminist and queer voices on Zionism, pinkwashing, and Barbie. We also continue our ongoing analysis of the crisis in Gaza. If we have a theme, it's about how power elites of whatever stripe co-opt and twist progressive movements to further their own interests, be they profit-making or the neo-colonial extermination of brown and black people. We begin our show with Jan Hawkins speaking to anti-Zionist activist Karen Shebovic about her experience growing up as a Zionist Jew. Fran Michel, our well-read Red, comments on the bourgeois feminism offered up by Barbie the movie, particularly galling in the context of genocidal attacks on women and children in Gaza. We finish up with Lori Mercier in conversation with Nishant Shahani about Israeli pinkwashing. It's the last week of our All Thrills, No Frills special programming campaign, and we need you, our listeners, to support KBOO. To contribute, go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. It's our members who make KBOO possible, so if you can, please donate today and help us reach our $22,000 goal. On March 18, a film called Israelism is screening at Clinton Street Theater. Unfortunately, the show is already sold out, although it is available for online viewing at filmsforaction.org/watch/Israelism. That link is posted on our webpage for this segment. This week, Jan Hawkins sat down with local anti-Zionist activist Karen Shebovic to talk about the themes of the movie, in particular, how many young Jews were raised to unconditionally love and support Israel, and only as young adults had to come to terms with the realities of the deadly Israeli subjugation of Palestine. Here's Jan with Karen.
Welcome to KBOO, Karen Shebovic.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Well, we'll be talking today about key themes in Israelism, a film that is screening in theaters and campuses across the country and coming to Portland on March 18th. The film unfolds around the stories of two filmmakers who produced Israelism and their process of confronting the place of Israel in their own Jewish identities. Karen Shebovic grew up in a Reform Judaism movement in Colorado and is a social worker and active in the queer anti-Zionist community here in Portland and a member of Jewish Voice for Peace Portland. Well, Karen, you visited Palestine, Israel twice as a young person, first with the Birthright program and later as a counselor for a teen trip. An early scene in Israelism centers on the formative experience for the film directors of their Birthright trip. Let's start with your own memories of that visit and how you came to understand that trip to Israel as a formative experience.
So, Birthright had always been a part of the trajectory of many people in my community. It was considered something that most people in my community did. And so when I was 19, I went on a Birthright trip without much thought politically about what that was or what that meant. And it was certainly before my politics had shifted to understand a little bit more about what Zionism is and how it works. I simply knew Zionism as a conflated part of my Judaism. And so going to Israel felt, especially on the Birthright trip, felt like at the time, a key part of my Jewish experience.
Can you say a bit even about the term birthright? I think many people know about the concept and being able to have a trip funded if you're an American Jew. I don't know if that's true for Jews around the world.
Okay, the question of birthright is one, it's based on the concept that Jews somehow have a right to visit the ancestral homeland and to live and occupy the land that is Palestine because of our historical connection to the land,
That this
which
is your true home. You're born into an identity as a Jewish American that also involves this idea of Israel as your home.
And I think folks who hold that belief believe that all Jews have some kind of a right to that land, which, as we know, a lot of people have historical connections to that land.
So, returning to your own memory of your trip, what do you recall?
Wow, so many things. Ironically, Birthright was a catalyst for me in questioning the place of Israel in my Judaism and starting to understand that the story of that land is much more complex than I was told as a child and as a young American Jew growing up in a Zionist bent Reform congregation and Reform movement. And I remember there's one moment in particular that I remember that my trip was visiting the YWCA, or sorry, the YMCA in Jerusalem, which at the time was run by a Palestinian man. It was right around the time that there was a lot of controversy about the wall, and he was talking about how he didn't think that the wall was very effective and that it separated people, not brought them together. And there was an Israeli soldier on our trip. Most Birthright trips, I think all Birthright trips have Israeli soldiers for at least a few of the days that are sort of on vacation from their army service and come and hang out as sort of cultural ambassadors to create strong connections between Israelis and American Jews. And one of those soldiers had been posted at the wall as part of his military service and as part of the Israeli occupation force service that he was serving in. And he left the room because he couldn't handle what this person was saying. And I just remember this deep feeling of, wow, there is more to this story than I have been told, because if these two people can't even be in the room together when talking about something as simple as coexistence, then there is something much more politically complicated than I was ever given the information about.
So the wall represented both a geographical barrier and boundary and a literal place, but also sounds like came to represent a kind of repression, that which is
Absolutely.
disavowed, disallowed, out of view. And for you, the wall at some point started tumbling down, like the wall of Jericho.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. It really shifted. And pushed me to think about that there was a nation state building a wall between citizens. And I was so confused because I had always been taught that apartheid was not a part of the state of Israel when it absolutely is.
So, can you talk about your process of questioning that story and how you came to see the story of Israel's founding and how you even understand the concept of Zionism? There are different versions of Zionism, and you're part of an anti-Zionist movement and group, Jewish Voice for Peace. How did you come to understand the term Zionism? And what that meant in your own Jewish identity.
It has been a long process, is one thing that I will say. And I think I came to understand Zionism as a subset of the colonial project through a lot of patient space. A lot of people gave me a lot of facts that I did not have access to about how so many Palestinian villages were destroyed in the Nakba. I think oftentimes when we're in conversation about Zionism, especially, we are working off of entirely different definitions. And when American Jews are in conversation with people who have an understanding of Zionism as a part of a colonial project, if they have never, like, if I'm just imagining myself in that conversation, that when people talk about the colonial project, it was frankly confusing, and I didn't have a framework to put it in because I had simply been given facts that were huge lies of omission and completely left out Palestinian history and narrative and the fact that Palestinians existed.
Yeah, I think one of the ironies among many in the accusation that any criticism of Israel is a form of anti-Semitism or among Jewish critics, self-hating, Jews or something along those lines, is that Judaism has been described as a religion and a tradition that produces tremendous curiosity, intellectual debate, two Jews, three opinions. And yet this seems to be shut down with respect to criticism of Israel, even now, amid what many in the world declare to be a genocide. And how do you understand that aspect of how things have unfolded? Given critique is and commentary and disagreement is so integral to Jewish intellectual life.
Absolutely. I think this is one of the tragic parts of the project of Zionism and the way that it colludes with anti-Semitism and colonialism, because I think the collusion of anti-Semitism and Zionism has made Jews afraid. And like I said, I grew up with this really intense fear that if Israel did not exist as a nation state, somehow I wouldn't be safe as a Jew. Which, as we think through the logic, and especially as I now know so many more facts, that it doesn't make any sense. I, especially these days when people talk about Jewish safety, I really have the question of, well, why can't we be safe here? Like, why are we not working on me having access to safety in the place that I live? There are Jews all over the world, and we deserve safety exactly where we are. That's sort of a side note, but how I understand that, in my opinion, tragic lack of engagement in the complexity in Jewish community and lack of acknowledgement in the Jewish community is because not is not because of anything inherent in Judaism itself. That Judaism does, like you said, encourage intellectual debate and complexity and engagement with that. But Zionism, which is separate, has claimed that Jewish safety is tied to the survival of the nation state and has used anti-Semitism as a shield, essentially, to say everyone should be afraid of anti-Semitism and everyone should be afraid of anti-Israel rhetoric.
That makes Jews unsafe inherently. And I think it's interesting now the reports coming out of what's called rampant anti-Semitism on campuses. Most of the findings in those reports are based on Jewish students who say they feel anxious or they feel unsafe at these pro-Palestine rallies rather than actual anti-Semitic actions or incidents. How do you respond to that concern about many Jewish students reporting feeling uncomfortable or anxious or worried about anti-Semitism with the war unfolding at the scale that we're seeing and the level of horror we're seeing?
I think my response, especially to those students, is to say we need to focus on what is important here. And of course, the feeling of being unsafe is not one that is fun. It is not easy to engage with, and it's something that we need to address, but we need to acknowledge the real root of the problem. The real root of the problem is not that people are asking for liberation and that Palestinians deserve liberation. The root of the problem is Zionism and the oppression faced by Palestinians and perpetuated by the State of Israel and by the Zionist movement.
Maybe there's something to that feeling, though, of like you were saying at the beginning, the wall started coming down, and their identification with something important and vital in their own identity is challenged. It can be very distressing and unsettling.
Absolutely. It is distressing and unsettling. And I would say I've been trying to use the metaphor of talking to people about anti-racist work when we're talking about anti-Zionist work, because in the same way that there was national conversation in 2020 about how uncomfortable it is for white people who have never thought about race before. And, I count myself among people who went through it, over the course of my life, lots of uncomfortable feelings about race as a white person, and the spaces to talk about racism, for example, for me to process my white feelings about racism is not appropriate with people of color. And in the same way, for Jews to process our big feelings about the way Zionism has hurt us and has made us feel unsafe is an important conversation, but not one to have with Palestinian folks, not one to have on the international scale, because as is usual with anti-Semitic cycles and with the cycle of anti-Semitism often serves as a distraction from other oppressions. And that we're seeing that come to play right now, that anti-Semitism is being used as a distracting force to say, let's pay attention to the ways that Jews are feeling unsafe instead of the ways that Palestinians are being actively genocided.
This is your host, Patricia Kohlberg, briefly interrupting this interview to remind you that time is running out. Support KABU during the last week of our All Thrills, No Frills special programming campaign. If you like what you're listening to and want to contribute to more cutting-edge and thrilling programming, please donate by going to kboo.fm/give, or you can mail a check to 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, 97214. Now back to Jan and Karen.
It was a point you made at a recent session with Multnomah County commissioners, and where there was moving testimony, some by members of Jewish Voice for Peace, some by members of the local Muslim community and Palestinian activists, and that one of the commissioners gave a speech on how the suffering of her family, and the problem of anti-Semitism must be addressed alongside calls for a ceasefire. What did you try to communicate to that commissioner? Because you said you felt her anguish. You were more empathic than some of the other activists there in saying you can understand how difficult this is, especially if you have, are a descendant of Holocaust survivors, though many of the most committed anti-Zionists in this movement are descendants of Holocaust survivors, draw very different lessons from the Holocaust.
Absolutely. And I think what I was attempting to communicate is sort of what I just said, that using anti-Semitism as a distraction is not an appropriate response right now. There's an act of genocide going on. We, especially as Jews, need to stand, and we know the implications of genocide. We, as a people, contain that in our bones. And we know the power also of people standing up and saying this is not okay. And so it's our turn to do that. It's our obligation, it's our moral obligation to do that and to put aside whatever feelings that we have or work through them so that we can show up for the Palestinian community. And so I just want to lift up also the work that If Not Now does, which I think is a really beautiful organization nationally that sort of focuses on that and targets American Jews to envelop them in the movement and say, we are going to organize as Jews to stand up for Palestinian liberation. And some of the work, it's all very action focused. And some of the ethos behind that is that Jews do need a Jewish space to process through what is going on for unlearning Zionism, but that does not have to be one that occupies international space.
And along those same lines, can you talk about the place of queer activists and activism in this, in the anti-Zionist movement? You identify as a queer anti-Zionist Jewish activist, and some of the traditions that are confronted in this movement are not friendly to queer politics. So, as is true in many places in the world, how do you see the place of queer activism in the anti-war peace and justice movement, as well as specifically anti-Zionist politics?
I think queer politics stand on the shoulders of many, many generations of queer folks, primarily Black and Brown trans folks that have really led the way in supporting solidarity movements. But I think one thing that stands out to me in queer anti-Zionist work is combating what's called pinkwashing. The way that Zionism and the state of Israel uses queer rights to mask other human rights violations. So things like highlighting the Tel Aviv Pride parade as a form of showing, wow, look how great we are at human rights. Don't look over here where we're actively imprisoning 2 million Gazans and genociding an entire people. The way that queer liberation is intersected feels very clear to me, and especially the way that queer liberation has been co-opted by the Zionist movement and attempted to use as another distraction.
Life in Tel Aviv is pretty attractive when you just zoom in on it and background a lot of what's behind the walls, and also in Israeli prisons, all of the young people who are swept up in Israeli prisons without clear charges, on without legal representation. Well, let's close out by talking a bit about the screening coming up. Israelism is a very interesting film. Follows some of your journey as well, and coming to terms with the legacy of Zionism and working to ground Jewish identity and the history of the Holocaust now in a different concept of justice than Israel represents. That screening at the Clinton Street Theater Monday evening, the March 18th, it's being sponsored by a number of local groups, including Jewish Voice for Peace, Portland's DSA, and the Portland chapter of Veterans for Peace. How can we find out more about the local activism and work of Jewish Voice for Peace?
Please follow JVP on Instagram. If you're a social media person, JVP PDX, you can go to jvpportland.org and find out more ways to get involved and ask around. Be calling your representatives every day if you can. There's lots of great ways to do that. One of them is on the JVP website, but don't turn away. There's an act of genocide happening, so get involved.
And you also are involved as a singer, and engaged in the what some call the resilience side of movements that can bring people into a lot of distress and confronting pain and horror, and how to draw on traditions of song and ritual that have an important place in sustaining activism. Can you say a bit about that as we close?
Absolutely. I think that one of many roles that I've dabbled in movements is to help build our communal resilience, which I think is really key, and especially Jewish anti-Zionist communal resilience in the face of a really deep Zionist culture in Jewish American spaces. So I believe in building more of that community so that we can support the liberation work of Palestinian leaders.
And it's reclaiming in the same way the civil rights movement and so many movements do, reclaiming sometimes liturgy, song, ritual practices through a liberation lens.
Absolutely. I'm hoping that we can continue to declare that Judaism at its core is a beautiful tradition that is not the same as Zionism, and that Zionism is not welcome in Jewish spaces.
Thank you so much for being with us today. This is the Old Mole Variety Hour. This is Jan Hawken talking with Karen Shebowick. Keep up the good work.
Thanks, Jan.
Shema Yisrael Adonai Listen, my people, our voices and bodies are one. Lifting voices together, we know that our work's just begun. Listen, my people, our voices and bodies are one. Lifting voices together, we know that our work's just begun. Shema Yisrael Adonai That was Jan Hawken speaking with anti-Zionist activist Karen Shebovic, followed by Karen herself singing the song Shema, or Let My People Sing. Again, the Portland showing of Israelism is sold out, but you can view the movie online at filmsforaction.org/watch/Israelism. That link is posted on the webpage for this segment. You are tuned to KBOO Portland. Barbie, the movie, is a hoot, as Fran Michelle admits in her following commentary. Even better, the Barbie meme can be repurposed for all sorts of radical causes. But the movie itself offers up a Hillary Clinton-esque sort of feminism that glosses over how the capitalist world order desecrates and destroys the lives of women. Here's Fran with her take on Barbie.
Barbie appears, at first sight, a very trivial thing and easily understood. Its analysis shows that it is, in reality, a very queer thing, abounding in magic and mystery. It stands with its toes on the ground and its heels in the air. Even before last summer's collective, creative outpouring of Barbenheimer memes led us to think about the shared roots of the bomb and the bombshell, there was the Barbie Liberation Organization, the BLO, swapping voice boxes between Barbies and G.I. Joes so that she said, "Vengeance is mine," and he said, "Math class is tough." The memes spilled over into Union Organizer Barbie, red shirt, copy of Das Kapital, and Land Back Barbie, tears, tiny U-lock. Portland's Mosquito Fleet displayed a shelter-in-place dream house with information about the dangers of fossil fuel spills and oil train explosions. The BLO presented eco-warrior Barbies, modeled on figures like Julia Butterfly Hill and Greta Thunberg. People make rebellious use of mass culture, and the campy absurdity of Barbie's world of hyperbolic gender without genitals seems to lend itself to that creative repurposing, as though it's already an imitation with no original, a copy of a copy, parody all the way down. So yeah, people will make creative and rebellious use of even the most plasticized elements of corporate mass culture. But also vice versa. In Greta Gerwig's live-action Barbie movie, the inciting event of the plot comes when stereotypical Barbie, played by Margaret Robbie, is affected by Mattel employee Gloria, played by America Ferrara, drawing pictures of alterna Barbies, like Irrepressible Thoughts of Death Barbie. In the film's Barbie Land, the lone figure marked by the off-script creativity so common in children's play is Weird Barbie, played by Kate McKinnon. With her hair chopped off, her plastic skin marked by crayons, she's incessantly doing the splits because someone played too hard with her. By August, Mattel had started selling a special edition Weird Barbie based on the character. There's a lot to like about the highest-grossing film of 2023. Much of it is quite funny, although, humor being what it is, your mileage may vary. There's the opening parody deflating the pomposity of Kubrick's 2001 A Space Odyssey with a tongue-in-cheek version of Barbie's origin story. The pitch-perfect detail of Barbie Land set design, the surreal vision of a live-action doll world. There's the reversal of what Laura Mulvey called the male gaze in Barbie Land, where Barbie has a great day every day, but Ken only has a great day if Barbie looks at him. There's the mockery of male ego when the Kens try to take over Barbie Land, but are distracted by the irresistible temptation to explain the Godfather or cryptocurrency or to play guitar at a woman for 4 hours. There's the Legally Blonde-style puncturing of expectations about dumb blondes every time Barbie comes out with some sophisticated articulation of a moderately complex idea. And there's the refreshing experience of seeing a mainstream big-budget film in which an intelligent tween girl gets to be caustic about the planet-killing dangers of capitalism. There's nothing wrong with a little escapism. Certainly there's enough in the world that we might want to forget for a couple of hours. And it's fun to share those memes and repurpose Barbie culture for our own ends. But of course, the pleasurable escapism of the movie has limits, and the still artificial plastic and pastel, quote-unquote, real world that the movie's Barbie visits when she leaves Barbie Land should not be mistaken for the actual real world we live in. In our real world, the average Mattel worker in 2017 made $6,300. Rithika Ramamurthy, writing in Nonprofit Quarterly last year, reads the Barbie film as an allegory for the company's pivot from a focus on manufacturing to a focus on franchising its intellectual property, as with its control of this film, in which, as one character comments, Mattel makes the rules. Ramamurthy writes, quote, "The U.S. corporation behind one of the world's best-selling toys is, like many industries, a horror story of corporate pressures exploiting overseas workers, dependent on low wages, dangerous conditions, and tax evasion to stay profitable. While the film, after its most popular product, does not represent this history, it portrays a world in which Mattel is all-powerful and in on the joke." End quote. As Tithi Bhattacharya noted last year in Truthout, Barbie lets us laugh at the patriarchy, but not at the expense of corporations. The film includes a speech from Gloria in which she lays out some of the double binds faced by women, a speech some viewers have seen as exemplary feminism and others have called strangely old-fashioned, but that Bhattacharya describes as, quote, "a Hillary Clinton campaign speech." Not the everyday advice working-class mothers are forced to give their daughters worldwide to make sure they at least get through high school or that they come home safe at night from their call center job. A bourgeois childhood ideal where we seek success within capitalism is portrayed as universal, made more acceptable by being voiced by a woman of color. Mattel, unsurprisingly, asks women to be bosses, not to fight them. End quote. Near the end of the film, Barbie wants to return with Gloria to the quote-unquote real world, but the ghost of Barbie inventor Ruth Handler, played by Rhea Perlman, tells Barbie that she can't let her become human without knowing what it means, so she grants her a vision of humanity. That vision consists of a montage of home movies and images of the friends and family of the film's cast and crew. For the movie's Barbie, being human evidently happens entirely in a bourgeois private sphere, where there's no sign of war, climate disaster, or any of the other ills of capitalism. When the nominations for the Academy Awards were announced, Barbie was nominated in 8 categories, including for Best Picture and Best Adapted Screenplay, but not including Margaret Robbie for Best Actress in a Lead Role or Greta Gerwig for Best Director. Disappointed fans of the film took to social media to say that the failure to recognize these women's accomplishments echoed elements of the movie's critiques of patriarchy. But as Aya El-Khaldi noted in Middle East Eye, the public conversation around the Oscars' so-called snub also became an opportunity to shine a light on Palestinian women's plight in the ongoing Israeli attack on Gaza. Among the fans offering consolation and praise for Gerwig and Robbie was, of all people, Hillary Clinton, who has repeatedly argued against a ceasefire. Reports on the situation in Gaza from UN Women and other sources indicate that 70% of those killed by Israel have been women and children. By March 1st, Israeli forces had killed at least 9,000 women in Gaza since October, with another 63 being killed each day. In the famine that Israel has created, almost every Palestinian in Gaza is going hungry, but mothers are especially likely to forgo food in order to feed their children with what little is available. The lack of basic hygiene is leading to women and girls suffering more urinary tract infections. There's no treatment for those whose IUDs have become infected. Pregnant people in Gaza are undergoing cesarean sections without anesthesia. While the Oscars brouhaha provided another route for calling attention to these atrocities, this is my least favorite form of repurposing Barbie culture. But at least we're probably safe from Mattel coming out with a genocide Barbie. No wonder we want to escape. For the Old Mole, this has been Fran Michelle.
Best thing you ever done for me is to help me take my life less seriously. It's only life after all, yeah. Well, darkness has a hunger that's insatiable, and lightness has a call that's hard to hear. And I wrap my fear around me like a blanket. I sail my ship of safety till I sank it. I'm crawling on your shores. I went to the doctor, I went to the mountains, I looked to the children, I drank from the fountains. There's more than one answer to these questions, pointing me in a crooked line.
That was from a song by the Indigo Girls called Closer to Fine. Before that, Fran Michel spoke about the real messages behind the superficially anti-patriarchal movie, Barbie. If you've enjoyed any of KABU's thrilling programming from the last month, be sure to show your support this last week by donating to kboo.fm/give, or you can text KBOO to 44321. Your contribution goes toward independent, cutting-edge, unique programming by the people and for the people. Earlier on the show, our guest Karen Shebovic mentioned the phenomenon of Israeli pinkwashing. Last on our show today is Lori Mercier in conversation with Nishant Shahani with more detail about pinkwashing, or how the State of Israel has tried to distract from or disguise the murderous apartheid state it has created by flaunting its embrace of the LGBTQ community.
Good morning. I'm speaking today with Nishant Shahani about pinkwashing in the context of Israel-Palestine. Shahani is professor of women's gender and sexuality studies in the Department of English at Washington State University, Vancouver. He's the author of the books Pink Revolutions, Globalization, Hindutva, and Queer Triangles in Contemporary India, and Queer Retrosexualities, The Politics of Reparative Return. He is co-editor of AIDS and the Distribution of Crises, and has also published essays in journals such as GLQ, Modern Fiction Studies, Journal of Visual Culture, QED, a Journal of LGBTQ Worldmaking, and Postcolonial Studies. Welcome to KABU, Nishant.
Thanks so much, Lori. It's an honor to be here.
Well, let's talk about pinkwashing. Tell us what it means and how it has been mobilized by Israel in relation to Palestine.
Sure. So pinkwashing is a term that has mostly been used by activists, political thinkers, scholars to talk about an explicit campaign by the government of Israel to market itself as anti-homophobic nation and a gay tourist destination. So pinkwashing is basically used as a detraction, sort of a smokescreen to obscure the violence of colonialism and occupation. And this is not necessarily a new tactic of colonialism, right? There have been many instances where colonialism takes on sort of a more benign appearance. We can also think of pinkwashing as a kind of national branding, right? A hijacking of LGBT queer politics to frame Israel as progressive, as cosmopolitan and modern. So what ends up happening is that the supposed LGBT-friendly nature of Israel is then invoked as a way to justify occupation of Palestine and to cover up policies of apartheid. And if these, you know, consumerist logics of gay tourism are invoked to frame Israel as liberal, then Palestine is conversely framed as backward, you know, primitive, homophobic, sexually depraved. So what critics of pinkwashing have asked is that when we talk about this ostensible gay friendliness of Israel, the question is friendly towards who, right? Which queer body is being welcomed? If your everyday being is restricted by the realities of occupation, by apartheid policies, by the confines of checkpoints, then there is nothing really queer or liberatory about that.
There's no pink door in the wall, is there?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Well, you know, you mentioned that pinkwashing as a strategy is not new. Could you talk a bit about its broader histories and genealogies?
Sure. So, yeah, as I mentioned, pinkwashing operates through a kind of messiah complex of saviordom, right? This idea that Israel and its democratic values protects its own queer citizens and can function as a savior of Palestinian queers too. And I think these logics of pinkwashing do have long histories and genealogies. And, the work of post-colonial feminism has pointed out that colonization operates through gendered logics where, the saving of native women by colonizers becomes the narrative, the pretext to justify and consolidate militarism and colonialism. Well-known post-colonial feminist critic Gayatri Spivak has called this colonial feminism, and one of the oft-repeated phrases, and I might be getting this quote a little incorrect, but it goes something like white men saving brown women from brown men. So we could see this as one possible, genealogy of pinkwashing. I also think that pinkwashing shares its ideological operations with something like greenwashing, right? Where you have PR campaigns of oil companies like British Petroleum, who actually invented this idea of the carbon footprint, right? Which poses very individual solutions for systemic problems, where, green consumerism is almost like a distraction device from how oil companies continue business models that increase carbon emissions. When I think about the term pinkwashing, in a different context, I think of the work of Samantha King, who's written this book called Pink Ribbons, Inc., where she talks about pinkwashing in the sense of how multinational companies donated charity to the cause of curing breast cancer, symbolized by the pink ribbon, while actually dwarfing public health initiatives and selling products containing chemicals that are actually, linked to the increase in the risk of cancer. So I think in all of these instances, we see how PR campaigns of progressivism, right, the ostensible concern over the plight of women, of LGBTQ people, of wellness, of eco-friendliness, these are co-opted as cover-ups for other kinds of material violence, right? I think one way to think of it would be, a kind of imperialism that is disguised as progressivism.
And it seems to me that U.S. corporations and the U.S. state have been quite nimble in adapting these so-called progressive ideologies to disguise its own imperialism and bombardment of other countries. I mean, if we look just more recently at the U.S. invasions of Iraq and Afghanistan's often women, this kind of purple washing using Western feminist ideas of justifying the kind of daily bombardment of civilian families demonstrates this kind of irony or hypocrisy.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it gets, more pronounced, particularly after 9/11. I mean, thinking about all the sort of the Gulf Wars and, the saving of Muslim women, you really get sort of that pronounced colonial feminist rhetoric in that context.
Yes. Well, what would you say are some of the ideologies and structural patterns of pinkwashing?
Yeah, I like to describe pinkwashing as a kind of fig leaf when, I'm talking about this to my students. It's almost as if it's a cover up, right, to obscure the violations of Palestinian human rights behind this image of, modernity signified by Israeli gay life. So, in essence, I would say that it is a distraction and distortion technique. In one of the classes that I'm teaching this semester, we've been returning to the work of, post-colonial Palestinian critic Edward Said, in which he talks about how Orientalism creates, and these are his words, an unchanging abstraction. And I think pinkwashing produces these unchanging abstractions through its investments in, sort of binary structures, right? Where Israel is marked as democracy, as progressive civilization, as opposed to Palestinians who are then framed as brutes, human animals, sexually depraved, homophobic. Palestinian children are seen as terrorists in waiting, right? Women are seen as insidious accomplices. So you have a repetition, a constant repetition of these problematic tropes.
Yeah, I mean, just thinking about the constant reference to Israel's need to defend itself, when in reality, most of the victims of its so-called defense have been children, and refusing to identify young people as children, but these terrorists in waiting, as you refer to them. And it also seems like this hypermasculinism of Israel and the IDF that even challenges the so-called gay-friendly or feminist-friendly identity of Israel, because it does seem to be pretty homophobic in its, hypermasculine militarism.
Yeah, absolutely. It's such a sort of a paradoxical discourse, right?
Can you talk some about the resistance and pushback to pinkwashing and its colonialist ideologies?
I think a critique of militarization has always been part of queer activism, right? I recalling the slogan by ACT UP, which is, AIDS Coalition to Unleash Power in, the late 90s, where they had this phrase, fight AIDS, not Arabs. And I just think that's so incredibly relevant today. ACT UP actually just joined in calling for a ceasefire. And it's this idea that, right, we are spending so much money on militarization that, of course, we don't have that money for healthcare, for affordable education, for housing. Queer politics has always been invested in a kind of redistributive politics. In terms of pushback, I also am thinking about this really excellent film that I use in my classes very often called Pinkwashing Exposed, and I hope we can link that with this interview. It's called Pinkwashing Exposed: Seattle Fights Back. It's directed by Dean Spade. And it's about a group of local queer Palestinian Jewish activists fighting back against, Israel's supposedly pro-LGBT propaganda machine. I think there's also been a very vocal pushback against pinkwashing by queer people through the rhetoric of not in my name, right? That you don't get to instrumentalize our queer identities to make occupation more palatable, right? More benign. Just as there has been very vocal response from organizations like Jewish Voices for Peace, who have been explicit about the fact that genocide and ethnic cleansing are not Jewish values, right? And so I think this rhetoric of not in my name does really powerful rhetorical and political work here. And finally, I also just want to quickly mention the work of queer groups such as ALQAWS, which is spelled ALQAWS, ALQAWS for Sexual and Gender Diversity in Palestinian Society, which is headed by, lesbian activist in Palestine. Her name is Hanine Mikey. These are grassroots groups that are indeed fighting against patriarchal and homophobic structures, but also foregrounding that, sexual liberation struggle cannot be divorced from the daily material realities of occupation and genocide.
And despite the so-called superiority of North America and Europe, there are plenty of groups in these countries that are fighting against homophobia. And it seems to me that these groups in Palestine are equally invested in eliminating patriarchy and homophobia as they are against imperial and settler colonialism.
Absolutely. Patriarchy and homophobia exist in so many different contexts, right? They're not essential to a particular part of the globe. And I think that's what pinkwashing does. It sort of reifies homophobia in relation only to, the Arab world, the Muslim world. And I think we really need to sort of push back against those kinds of essentializations.
And there are plenty of Palestinians who've been forced to leave
Absolutely.
Palestine who are now working for some of these LGBTQ groups in other countries.
Yes. Yeah.
Well, this is Laurie Mercier for the Old Mole Variety Hour, and I've been speaking today with Nishant Shahani, Professor of Women's Gender and Sexuality Studies at Washington State University, Vancouver, about pinkwashing. And we will link to the film that Nishant mentioned, Pinkwashing Exposed, and provide some other links about pinkwashing on the Old Mole website. Thanks so much for joining us today, Nishant.
Thanks so much, Laurie.
That was a clip from the song called Queen, an acronym for Queer, Untouchable, Emigrant, Excommunicated, Negroid, performed by Janelle Monáe and Erica Badu. Before that, Laurie Mercier was speaking with Nishant Shahani about Israeli pinkwashing. And that does it for our show today. I want to thank Moles, Jan Hocken, Fran Michel, and Laurie Mercier for their contributions. And a special thanks to our guests, Karen Shebovic and Nishant Shahani. Our gratitude, as always, for the hardworking KABU staff. I'm Patricia Kohlberg, and I've been your host for the hour. This week is your last chance to support KABU by donating to our winter fund drive. Better yet, become a member and a monthly sustainer. You can do all this by going to kboo.fm/give. Or texting KBOO to 44321. Please do your part to keep community radio alive in Portland. I'm going to leave you today with more from that Alicia Keys song, Girl on Fire. Catch us again next Monday morning at 9 a.m. for more views, reviews, and interviews from the ground up. Thanks for listening.
Looks like a girl, but she's a flame. So bright she can burn.